It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Ann Strainchamps. Today, we're asking the question, was Karl Marx right? You know, not that long ago, when the Berlin Wall came tumbling down, everyone thought Marxist ideology had bitten the dust and that history had proved the great critic of capitalism, Karl Marx, wrong. But today, believe it or not, Marxism is back. And Steve Paulson, who has put together today's show, is here to tell us why. Steve, what's going on?
Well, this new interest in Marxism is really a critique of capitalism more than a blueprint for any kind of socialist or communist future. And it goes back to the economic crisis of 2008. And there are a lot of people now who believe there is a basic structural problem with capitalism itself, that the people who've really benefited from any kind of economic comeback that we've had are the very rich, the so-called 1%, and this has spawned all kinds of protest movements, Occupy Wall Street, the mass protests against the new austerity measures in Europe.
Are you saying we're seeing a whole new Marxist movement on the rise?
Yeah, I don't think we should kid ourselves. This is not a mass movement, but it's become intellectually respectable, once again, to talk about Marxism and to talk about Karl Marx himself, because he made arguably the most systematic and trenchant critique of capitalism we've ever seen. And what's really interesting is we're seeing a lot of this among young people right now who came of age after the Cold War. I mean, they don't feel like they have to contend with the baggage of the gulags and the Soviet show trial, so they can look at Marxism with fresh eyes.
So I take it we're going to hear from some of the people who are rethinking Marx's legacy. What have you got for us?
Well, actually, we're going to start with an old-time British Marxist, Terry Eagleton, who's been around for decades, and he recently wrote a book called Why Marx Was Right.
First of all, I don't believe, of course, that Marx was right in everything. Far from it. He made a lot of important blunders and errors, had a lot of blind spots. But what I do in the book is take 10 of the most familiar criticisms of Marx, that, you know, he reduced everything to economics, that he dismissed the spiritual, that he was a determinist historically, that he believed in a strong centralized state, that he believed in a perfect future. He was a utopianist. And I try and show how all of these are radically mistaken. He didn't believe any of that. And the other thing that people don't know or forget about Marx is what a champion of capitalism he was.
What do you mean, a champion of capitalism?
Well, the Communist Manifesto is a paean of praise to capitalism. It says that the bourgeoisie, the European middle classes, were the most revolutionary force in human history. In a few brief centuries, they transformed the face of the earth. They threw out the old ways of doing things, and they established democracy and liberalism, and they accumulated more fabulous wealth than history had ever known. Marx is not simply saying, you know, that capitalism is in some abstract and absolute sense bad. He's saying, how come that we have here the most fabulously developed and affluent regime the world has ever witnessed, and we have destitution, poverty, exploitation, inequality, and so on? What are the mechanisms whereby that happens?
The great paradox of capitalism is that countries and people can get very wealthy, and yet there still is tremendous poverty, exploitation, inequality. Those social ills, those financial ills, seem to be intractable.
That's the question Marx asks. He doesn't just in some abstract way denounce capitalism, you know. He inquires into its internal contradictions, exactly what you're talking about, the way in which it keeps generating poverty and riches at the same time, freedom and exploitation, equality and inequality. He's not saying, well, there's a little bit of this and there's a little bit of that. You know, he's saying these two narratives are as close as the two sides of a sheet of paper. And he wants to know why. And in posing that question, I think he's actually quite original. There's not a great deal in Marx that's original. The idea of communism isn't original. The idea of revolution isn't original. But this, I think, is.
Now, there are a few standard criticisms of Marxism. To start with, it would seem the great Marxist experiments, the countries that tried to create new societies based on Marx's ideas, the Soviet Union and China especially, they turned out to be disasters.
It is indeed. No Marxist until Stalin, I think, believed that it was possible to construct socialism in a desperately backward, isolated, run-down society. That's why Marx talks about the great accumulation of wealth, not just material wealth, but cultural, spiritual wealth, which capitalism has piled up. His point is, how is this to be reorganized to the benefit of all? Not, you know, how could one build world, a complex socialist society starting from almost nothing. So the idea that you could simply, as it were, leap from economic backwardness into a socialist future was basically invented by Stalin in the 1920s. Until then, every Marxist thought that you could really only go socialist if you had the resources to do so.
And do you think Karl Marx was right?
Well, I think that he said at one point in his work that if you tried it that way, he said what you will end up with is generalized scarcity. And in a way, that's a term for Stalinism, you know, generalized scarcity. If you have to accumulate capital from a very, very low and backward level, you will need a strong state. You'll have a political tyranny and all the horrors that follow.
And yet my impression is that in recent decades, an awful lot of people on the left really don't want to talk about Marx anymore. I mean, there's too much baggage when you mention his name and certain ideas, yeah. like communism, the dictatorship of the proletariat, the bourgeoisie. I mean, this just sounds antiquated to talk about these things.
Yes, although, of course, the international bourgeoisie have become much more powerful and much more concentrated. Inequalities have widened. Imperialism has been rampant. So, revolutions have happened. So I don't think it's quite as antiquated a language as some people think. But it doesn't concern me greatly if people in and around the Occupy movement or, you know, political radicals are not particularly concerned with Marx. I don't think that the real question is, are you a devotee of Karl Marx or not? And indeed, what it means to be a Marxist. I mean, how many doctrines do you have to sign on for is an interesting question. The 39 articles. It's been an ongoing matter of controversy within the Marxist camp. What counts as Marxism, you know? So I think what's more important is that some sort of critique of capitalism nevertheless has grown up, as one would expect in the dire circumstances, you know, of bankers ruining the lives of millions of people and then getting away without a jail sentence. That's outrageous enough, you know, whereas some young guy who steals a can of Coke, you know, gets put behind bars for a year.
Are you saying that it's that the best way to understand Marx is as a critic of capitalism rather than as a prophet of some future society that will replace capitalism?
Oh, absolutely. And I'm sure that Marx would have said, in fact, he almost did say, that's how he understood his own work. Marx is famously has very little to say about the future. He doesn't believe in blueprinting. He doesn't believe in some perfect society. There's nothing in Marx that talks about utopia and perfection. He doesn't believe in that, partly because the future will be, for him, freedom. And you can't pre-program freedom. All you can say is what would it take, how to get there. And that's really what Marxism is all about. It's about trying to unlock the contradictions and the obstacles which prevent us from getting to that point. Marx isn't a clairvoyant.
One of the things that I find most interesting about your reading of Marx is that you say it's a mistake to see him strictly as a materialist, you know, someone who reduces everything to economics and labor conditions, that it's actually better to see him as someone who was looking for a spiritual life.
Well, first of all, Marx was one of those formidably cultivated German intellectual in the great German tradition. Yes, I mean, he was staggeringly erudite in music, in literature, which I regard as spiritual forms. I think that's a valid use of the word spiritual. And if he was a materialist, it wasn't because he reduced everything to matter. Marx didn't give a damn about questions like that. He would have dismissed them as purely metaphysical and idle. By materialism, he means let's start from the practical, sensuous behavior of men and women.
Well, and you say Marx's real goal was not labor, it was leisure. That's what he wanted to do. He wanted a society that gave people more leisure time.
Well, that's the only reason why I'm a Marxist. There are only two good reasons. Well, one is just to annoy people you don't like, you know, people you bump into at parties and so on. And the other is because I just don't like having to work. You know, I have deep-seated principled objections to work, you know. I think, you know.
So Marx was, or he aspired to be a slacker.
Yes. Or if you want to be a slacker, then become a Marxist. That's the best way to do it. Marx believed that it was feasible to reorganize production in a way that released us, most of the time at least, from the more degrading forms of toil. And he asked, you know, why aren't we doing that? Why, for example, are we using technologies to increase exploitation rather than to alleviate it? The reason he was so concerned with economics was to lessen, to diminish their tyrannical power over men and women. He saw men and women in our kind of society as harassed, driven, obsessed by the means of life. Yeah? He's saying, what would it be like if we had a kind of society which could, as far as possible, release men and women into simply trying to fulfil themselves in whatever way they wanted? And about that, he's absolutely not prescriptive. What he does say, very interestingly, and again, this is something that people just don't know about Marx, when he comes to think about production, he doesn't think about coal mines, he doesn't think about cotton mills, he thinks about art. Because for Marx, art is the paradigm of human production. And the reason for that is that art is a creative realization of men and women's capacities purely for its own sake, purely, if you like, for the hell of it. And Marx deeply objects to a society in which he feels our capacities, our creativity has become instrumentalized. You know, it's only valuable if it's for some practical material end. That's not unique to him. That's part of the great German classical humanist tradition.
Cultural critic Terry Eagleton talking with Steve Paulson about his book, Why Marx Was Right. So what do you think? Does Marxism still matter? You can share your thoughts on our website at ttbook.org or on our Facebook page. Karl Marx's ideas may be back, but the man himself is alive too, at least on stage. Activist actor Brian Jones stars in the one-man show Marx in Soho, a play written by the late historian Howard Zinn. The story goes that Marx is tired of being declared dead again and again, and he wants to come back to clear his name, so he's agitating against the authorities of the afterlife. In this scene, he reflects on his longtime comrade and rival, the Russian anarchist, Mikhail Bakunin.
Do you know him, Bakunin, the anarchist? If a novelist invented such a character, you would say the existence of such a person is not possible. To say that Bakunin and I did not get along is a great understatement. For instance, listen to what he wrote when Engels and I were in Brussels working on the manifesto. Marx and Engels, and especially Marx, are ingrained bourgeois. We are ingrained bourgeois. Of course, to Bakunin, everyone was bourgeois, because he chose to live like a pig. Now, if you did not live like a pig, if you had a roof over your head, if you occasionally enjoyed some fresh bread and wine, if you had a piano in your sitting room, you were a bourgeois. Now, I grant the man courage. He was imprisoned, sent to Siberia, escaped. He wandered the world trying to foment revolution everywhere. He wanted an anarchist society. The only anarchism he ever succeeded in setting up was in his own head. He tried to start an uprising in Bologna, and he almost shot himself with his own revolver. Bakunin's head was full of all kinds of anarchist garbage. Romantic, utopian nonsense. I wanted to expel him from the International. Jenny said, "Why do revolutionary groups with 6 members always threaten somebody with expulsion?"
That's an excerpt from the one-man play Marx in Soho. Brian Jones has toured with it for more than a decade. You can learn a lot about a character in that time.
You know, he was a little rough around the edges. He was a brawler in his youth. He would be in bar fights and that sort of thing. He was very sick and covered with boils. He was known to rub people the wrong way and not a very polite individual. So I wanted Marx to be a little bit disheveled, a little rough around the edges and show that, but also show the kind of keen intellect. The idea is that the powers that be are letting Marx come back from the dead for an hour to defend his ideas. And he comes back. He intended to go to Soho, London, where he lived when he was alive. But by a bureaucratic error, he's sent to Soho, New York. So he's commenting on what he sees around him in 20th century or 21st century America. And he's, I think, trying to defend his ideas and explain why, even in his day, he said, you know, I am not a Marxist, because his ideas were so distorted, even in his day.
So anyway, I was telling you about Pieper. You see, in London, the political refugees from the continent marched in and out of our house. Pieper was one of them. He was a flatterer, a sycophant. He buzzed around me like a hornet. He would station himself 6 inches from me so that I could not evade him. And quote from my writings, I used to say, "Pieper, please don't quote me to myself." He had the audacity to say, thinking I would be pleased, that he would translate Das Kapital into English. Ha! English is a beautiful language. It's Shakespeare's language. If Shakespeare had heard Pieper speak one sentence of English, he would have taken poison. Jenny felt sorry for him. She used to like to invite him to our family dinners. One evening he came and announced the formation of the Marxist Society of London. A Marxist society? I asked. What's that? We meet every week to discuss another of your writings. We read aloud and examine sentence by sentence. That's why we call ourselves Marxists. We believe completely and wholeheartedly in everything you've ever written. Completely and wholeheartedly, I asked. Yes, and we would be honored, Herr Dr. Marx. He always called me Herr Dr. Marx. If you would address the next meeting of the Marxist Society. Well, I cannot do that. Why not? Because I'm not a Marxist.
Brian Jones stars in the one-man play Marx in Soho, written by the late historian Howard Zinn. Now, why is it somehow not surprising that there was a woman behind Marx's success? Coming up, the untold story of Jenny Marx. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. We're talking about the renewed interest in Marxism today. There have been so many books written about Marxism and Karl Marx himself, but not much about his wife, Jenny, which is a bit strange because Marx's marriage and family life had a profound influence on his thinking. That's why Mary Gabriel wrote her book, Love and Capital, Karl and Jenny Marx and the Birth of a Revolution.
There hadn't been anything written about Marx, the family man. And that was really a significant part of his life and a real foundation for his work.
Well, you know, the other remarkable thing about this is Marx's personal life was, it's such a story. I mean, it's like something straight out of Dickens.
Exactly. After writing this, I could never look at Marx's works again in the same way. I always thought of them as sort of the musings of a really cold, cerebral individual, when in fact he was the exact opposite.
Well, bring him to life for us, if you would, because the Marx we all know is the solemn-looking guy with that great big bushy beard. He looks kind of stern and uncompromising. Mm-hmm. So that's the popular image. How accurate is it?
It's not very accurate at all. The Marx that I discovered through his family was a reckless, jovial, prankster, frivolous, utterly irresponsible, bit of a drunk. Mm. You know, sometimes he's referred to as a womanizer. He wasn't really. I mean, he had one big personal flaw and an involvement with a lifetime family helper, which resulted in a son who he abandoned. But generally, he was an utterly flawed individual who, despite his flaws, I, anyway, came to really enjoy because of his sense of humor, because of his struggle, because of his passion for this greater mission, which he declared for himself when he was a young man, you know, at the age of 17. He decided he would set out to save the world, to save humankind.
Now, your book is not just a biography of Karl Marx. It's really the portrait of a marriage, his marriage to Jenny. Some people have called her the real hero of the book. Tell us about her.
She really is. In fact, I think that of the two, she was the braver individual. She was the daughter of a baron, so she was born into the Prussian aristocracy. She could have had a life of utter ease and respect, but she chose, at the same time that Karl was making this declaration to save mankind when he was 17, she was 4 years older than he was. She was 21, and she had learned these same lessons from her father about socialism and the Enlightenment and German Romanticism and all of these ideas that were really not the things that most young women at that time learned. She absorbed and believed, and she made a commitment to work for the betterment of mankind as deeply as Marx did. But unfortunately, because the way society was structured, as a woman, she couldn't do that in a public way. Her only real choice was to align herself with a man who could do that. But she was a very strong force behind Marx. Her sacrifices were, in fact, much greater than his. So her story is really, it has all of the emotional range that you could possibly want out of a figure in a novel. She was beautiful, she was tragic, she was heroic, she was brilliant, but she had to take a back seat to Marx just strictly because of that's how society was in the 19th century.
And for all that he was sensitive to the oppression of the working classes, he doesn't seem to have noticed anything about the oppression of women.
Exactly. Marx and Engels, his closest friend and collaborator, were really writing in a time in the 19th century when women's rights were in the background, but they weren't really discussed.
You mentioned that Jenny's life was a tragic one. How so?
When she decided to marry Marx, she knew this was going to be an adventure, but she had a feeling, this is my sense from her letters and her responses to situations, that it would always be one of semi-comfort and respect. But about 5 years into their marriage, they'd landed in London, penniless, they didn't know the language, they didn't have many friends. They had no clear future. She had three children, three young children, all under the age of five. And I think then she probably realized the extent of what her marriage to Marx would mean. And from that moment on, her life became fairly dark. She had seven children. Of those seven children, she lost four of them. And it would be safe to say that all four died of poverty-related diseases.
Didn't you write that at one point they couldn't even afford a coffin for one of their children?
The second daughter who died, and that was when she had just turned one. There were seven people living in a two-room apartment, and the baby's coffin was put in one room, and they moved all the bedding into the other room so everyone could sleep and live their lives in the room apart from the corpse of the child. But that wasn't even the most tragic loss. The tragic loss was their eight-year-old son, who was really the lifeblood of the family. He was the one who, in the darkest moments, kept them all going because he was a little entertainer and he was a really wonderfully bold spirit. And it would have been so great to see what he would have turned into if he'd survived. But he died of a disease that was definitely related to poverty, and that nearly destroyed the family. And in fact, Jenny never recovered from that death. They lived many years by selling things to the pawn shop. She, at times, didn't have a coat that she could wear because she had given that to the pawn shop in order to buy food. She had a constant series of creditors at her door knocking.
What was Karl Marx doing all this time?
Well,
why wasn't he better able to support his family?
Well, he was like an artist who is single-mindedly absorbed in his work. He had made some arrangements with newspapers that he would do several articles a week. And Friedrich Engels had decided that he would go work for his father's Manchester factory in order to help the Marx family survive. But it was never enough money. There were always enormous doctor bills, and because they were always in debt, they had high interest payments. But Marx, only once in his life did it actually occur to him that he might get a job, I mean a real kind of 9-to-5 job. And then he applied for a job at a rail agency in London, but he didn't get the job because his handwriting was so bad. But he was just absolutely blinded to the daily concerns and problems of his family and those around him, because he was committed to this much bigger mission. He had this incredible optimism that what he was writing was going to change the world immediately and, P.S., bring in enough cash that his family could survive. And he always thought there was going to be a revolution around the corner. He was blind to everything but his writing and his work.
So he was a dreamer and,
exactly,
and impractical and not terribly sensitive to the sufferings of the people who he was closest to, whom he actually loved. Were his children and was his wife Jenny, were they angry at him?
That's the
amazing
thing.
As they were off begging and selling their shoes in order to eat, and he was off to the British Reading Room to write some more.
Yeah, no, that's the amazing thing. They were never angry. Jenny, she and the daughters, Marx's three surviving daughters, so believed in his work. They were as committed as he was. There was one daughter, his middle daughter, Laura, who lost three of her children while she was on the continent in France, working with her husband to promote Marx's ideas. And all three of her children died while she was out politicking and her husband was out politicking. They were being chased by police from France to Spain. After the death of her third child, I think she died to her father's philosophy. But she continued to work in the family business, which was Marx's work. But I don't think she ever believed in it like a religion as her other sisters and her mother did.
The family sacrificed an awful lot to her father's goal. I think two of the surviving daughters later, after their parents had died, committed suicide, didn't they?
Yes, Marx's youngest daughter, Eleanor, known by the family as Tussie, she was really the most tragic of the three. In fact, Marx said Jenny, his oldest daughter, was most like him, but he said Eleanor, his youngest daughter, was him. She had a ferocious personality and a vibrancy and a strength of, you know, 10 people. She worked as a labor agitator on her own, and she developed her own political connections, and she was much more her own political person than either of her sisters or her mother. Unfortunately for her, she hooked up with an English semi-socialist, semi-playwright, mostly a real scoundrel con man, and moved in with him. He was already married, but she made the social sacrifice to move in with him. And when his first wife died, which made him legally eligible to marry another woman, instead of marrying Eleanor, with whom he'd lived for 14 years, he married a young actress. And on the day Eleanor found out about that, she took cyanide and killed herself. And so her career was just absolutely the most magnificent, but also the most tragic.
Well, so far, the story of Marx's family is pretty much an unrelenting tragedy.
Yeah.
How did that change your thinking about Marx's ideas?
I want to say, even though it does sound like it was a tragedy, there's also just this incredibly rich life of ideas and fun and, you know, wild adventure. If you imagine being a child in that household and the people you met and the ideas you were introduced to, you were being introduced to the most radical new ideas of the century, basically. And that's where you lived. That's where you lived physically and mentally. I really came to appreciate not just the sacrifices they made, but the difficulties in which he wrote. There was one moment when he couldn't go to an event because he had sent his last coat to the pawn shop and he didn't have anything to wear. So he was trying to write these incredibly earth-changing ideas at the very time that he was penniless. He didn't know where the food was going to come from. He didn't know what he was going to eat. So it wasn't just that they were suffering. He was suffering too. And despite all of that, coming out of his study was a set of ideas, whether you agree with them or not, that changed the world and continue to change the world today and remain as controversial today as they were in the 19th century when he wrote them.
Mary Gabriel is the author of Love and Capital, Karl and Jenny Marx and the Birth of a Revolution. The resurgence of Marxism has attracted some unlikely converts, including the novelist Benjamin Kunkel. In the literary world, he's a celebrity, co-founder of the magazine N+1, author of a highly praised novel, and now he's added a new item to his resume, Marxist public intellectual. He's just published a collection of political essays called Utopia or Bust. Steve Paulson recently caught up with Benjamin Kunkel to talk about the new generation of Marxists and a surprising new bestseller.
Ben, certainly the book of the moment is the French economist Thomas Piketty's Capital in the 21st Century. And we should point out that Piketty himself is not a Marxist. But why do you think his book has struck such a nerve right now?
I think it has struck a nerve for two reasons. On the one hand, he's talking and talking very intelligently and above all with a command of data that seems to me absolutely unrivaled about the development of economic inequality in our own time and across two centuries of industrial capitalism. And that part of the book is really magnificent. And this has obviously touched a nerve, in part because this is one of the issues of the day. Obama himself has called it the great challenge of our time, something like that, economic inequality. But of course, Marxists and others on the left have been discussing the same problem with a lot of intelligence and sophistication for a long time, but they do so from the position of being Marxist and therefore being not respectable. And the advantages that Piketty has had include not only his real intelligence and his research, but the fact that he comes from what they call a neoclassical economic background, that as a young prodigy he taught at MIT. That is to say, he's somebody with the credentials to come out and say, well, if it looks like capitalism is not doing what we want it to do, that it is only someone like Piketty, who's not a Marxist and who has the neoclassical credentials and the PhD in economics, that we, in some sense, still need from somebody, most of us, if we're going to listen to someone who we feel has authority and hear him say that capitalism might not be going the way that we want it to.
Now, one of the things that Piketty is advocating is a global progressive wealth tax, which politically would seem to be an absolute non-starter. Is this even worth talking about?
I suppose, you know, being a utopian myself, I think political non-starters are often worth talking about so that we can think about what we actually can get done. There's a strange way in which Piketty's global wealth tax is, in its very realism and its modesty, totally utopian and unrealistic, because in order to accomplish something like this globally, you would need not just one country and not just two countries, but really every important country to say, we're going to apply to our most powerful citizens, we're going to apply this wealth tax and do it in coordination with every other country in the world and not be tempted by the idea of becoming some sort of tax haven. And frankly, it seems to me much more likely that you would have socialist revolution, whether accomplished by the ballot or by some other means, in a series of large countries. I'm not predicting that that's going to happen anytime soon, but it seems to me much more likely that you would have blocks of countries in the world change their mode of production.
Now, do you think we're starting to see more receptivity to, I don't know what we want to call them, Marxist ideas, socialist ideas around the world? I mean, is there a new generation that's emerging now that is open to this kind of radical critique of capitalism?
I do think that there's a generational element to it, partly because the younger a person is, the less likely he is or she is to associate Marxism with a command economy and with this atrocious totalitarian system, and the more likely they are to have grown up in a situation which is rough for many people economically right now, but in which youth unemployment in this country, but in other countries even more so, is really extreme. Clearly, that's not a capitalism that is working for people.
Well, and there was a Pew poll, I think, a couple of years ago of maybe it was people in the U.S. Polling those between the ages of 18 and 29, and something like half of them were sympathetic to socialism, which is kind of an astonishingly high number.
Yes. Yeah, of course, what we need to do is to figure out what we exactly mean by socialism, or at least the type of socialism that we want, and also probably get a clear idea of what we mean by capitalism. When I was growing up, I just figured that capitalism meant the market and that it sounded terrible to live in a socialist country because it meant that you couldn't have any great variety of products to buy, and even those that you might want would be in shortage. You'd have to stand in very long lines for them and so forth. And one of the interesting things about Piketty's book, and one of its flaws, I think, is that he continues to make this identification between markets as such and capitalism. And one of the things that it seems to me that we need to recognize is that markets have long predated capitalism and that there's no reason for them not to survive in some form after capitalism. A number of goods are not supplied only through the market, education, for example, and health. So I think what we need to do is to start talking a lot more about what it is that capitalism actually is and what it is that socialism might be.
So you're imagining some kind of a new way of thinking about a market economy, a Marxist model for a viable market economy?
Yes. I think that there's no necessary incompatibility between markets and socialism. And the great question, it seems to me, is exactly what we're willing to put a price on and what we're willing to put a minimum or maximum price on. You could certainly have a market economy in which there was a very high minimum wage or better than that, a universal guaranteed income, a universal basic income, and also a maximum income. You could have ratios of wealth that were only 10 to 1 or something like that, or even 3 to 1 if you like, and still have a market economy.
Now, I'm really curious about your own story here because, I mean, you're best known as a novelist and you're a co-founder of the literary and cultural journal N+1. And now you've written a collection of essays on mostly Marxist thinkers. And as you put it in your introduction, you seem to have become a Marxist public intellectual. What brought you to this political turn?
I've at moments regretted writing that line because it seems to me a bit of a joke to be a Marxist public intellectual because the public isn't very large, although thanks to you, perhaps it's getting a bit larger.
So why? Why are you now writing, political essays in the Marxist tradition?
I don't know. I've wanted to be a writer since I was a kid, since I was a teenager, if not before. And I used to write poetry, and I thought, maybe one day I will be a poet. Then I wrote a lot of fiction. But I'm just a writer, really, and then I try and write what I feel most like writing. And perhaps this ends up being too great a variety of things, in that I've written a fair amount of literary criticism. I've written these political essays. I'm trying to write a book that really amounts to a political treatise, which is something of an embarrassing thing to say since I don't know that we use the word treatise anymore, except ironically.
Do you see much connection between your political writing and your what I would call literary writing, writing fiction or writing drama?
Both yes and no. The no may be more interesting and surprising than the yes. Writing very directly now about economics and politics has made me feel that there's less necessity of addressing those things in my fiction. And so the novel I'm working on right now has nothing to do with politics, or at least nothing explicitly to do with politics. And I guess I've told myself that here we are living in neoliberalism or late capitalism or fossil capitalism or whatever you want to call it, and anything that I or anyone else end up writing honestly about our moment will have some political bearing, but that I don't need to address politics directly.
But what you're saying is if you're going to write a novel, you're going to have to deal with questions of, let's say, social class in there. I mean, that's part of the territory of what a novelist does in this day and age.
Exactly, yeah. And in this sense, Jane Austen probably told us more about the capitalism of her day by not trying to tell us anything than she would have had she conceived of herself as a political novelist.
Benjamin Kunkel is the author of the novel Indecision and a collection of political essays called Utopia or Bust. He talked with Steve Paulson. Moving on from Marx, when we come back, the lure of money. Novelist Colson Whitehead tells us what happened when he went to Vegas to play in the World Series of Poker. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. And now, bookmarks, writers on books they love.
Hi, I'm Walter Kern, the author of Blood Will Out, the true story of a murder, a mystery, and a masquerade. The book I'd love to recommend to everyone is The Dog of the South by Charles Portis. The book is a one-of-a-kind story of a man whose wife runs off to Mexico and who decides to follow her credit card receipts. He gets in all sorts of adventures along the way. He sort of never finds what he's looking for. And it's the perfect kind of Shaggy Dog story in the sense that it has no real structure, no real plot, no big payoff. It's just that every conversation, every observation, every moment of contemplation on the part of the narrator is perfectly comically timed and written in a style that's so effortless you can't believe you're not just reading the author's thoughts. This is probably the only truly funny comic novel written in the last 30 years that you can read without embarrassment. Portis is as big a recluse as J.D. Salinger ever was, or Thomas Pynchon is. He's a real mystery man as a writer, but this book, which I consider his masterpiece, shows him probably to be the funniest human being alive who you've never met. It came out in the early 70s, and I believe it was obscure for a lot of years and then was republished in the 90s. That's when I read it. It's a book that's passed around among writers because its dialogue and the quality of its prose is kind of miraculous. It's both funny and completely elegant and stylish. I reread it probably every year. It's one of those books that I use to sort of keep my blade sharp. The book is very influential for writers because it proves that you can be both funny and incisive and perfectly elegant at the same time. Portis, who also wrote True Grit, is a kind of master of the sentence that makes you smile and then goes off in your head 30 seconds later and makes you laugh out loud. You don't even appreciate how good he is as you're reading. It keeps catching you. It's like music that sticks in your head. And, you know, once you've been exposed to the music of his thought and his humor and his prose, you can't get enough of it. It's one that everybody who reads it reads again.
Walter Kern recommends The Dog of the South by Charles Portis. You can find more bookmarks on our website at ttbook.org. And now it's time for On Our Minds. This week, Colson Whitehead's new book, The Noble Hustle, is on our minds. Whitehead's a celebrated novelist who got the magazine assignment of a lifetime, 7 days in Las Vegas, playing in the World Series of Poker. His new book's full of comic riffs about the angst of a novelist who tries to swim with the big fish of the poker world. Our producer, Doug Gordon, asked Whitehead to read an excerpt from the book.
Quite a few things about poker reminded me of the writing life. Like, you sat on your ass all day. That was a huge one. And we were all making up stories, weaving narratives. Pros will talk about the story you're telling with your hand. A hand possesses a narrative arc with a setup, rising action, and denouement. Each time you throw money into the pot, you're telling a story, from the opening call to the river re-raise. As St. Harrington put it, a player is nothing more than the sum of his betting patterns. You must fake out their reads. The day-to-day horror of writing gave me a notion of tournament time. Writing novels is tedious. When will this book be finished? When will it reveal its bright and shining true self? It takes freaking years. At the poker table, you're only playing a fraction of the hands, waiting, ever waiting for your shot. If you keep your wits, can keep from flying apart while those around you are self-destructing, devouring each other, you're halfway there. Poker players and writers are always inside the game and also outside the game, observing it. When I whipped out my notebook, no one blinked. I could have been recording bad beats, misplayed hands, or assembling a dossier on the other players. No one cared what I scribbled. Like when you write a book.
That was great, Colson. So let's talk about your experience playing in the World Series of Poker in Vegas. This was in 2011. Grantland hires you to do this and write about it for them. So they pony up the entrance fee for you to participate, right? How much was that?
$10,000. You know, they were just starting up and wanted to know if I wanted to write about sports, but I hate sports. And then we sort of landed on this. You know, as a home player, someone who plays, has played in a monthly game with a $5 buy-in for 12 years, I couldn't say no. So I had to get sort of more serious. And the first thing I did was get a poker coach. named Helen Ellis, who was a writer who had been sort of stepping up her presence on the poker circuit. And she agreed to take me on as her sort of protege and tell me where to play in Atlantic City, which books to read, how to maintain proper nutrition. The World Series is a 12-hour stint at the tables, and you got to manage your calories.
Yeah, didn't you actually hire a personal trainer? Besides having Helen as your coach, didn't you hire a personal trainer to toughen you up for sitting like the 12 hours straight?
Yes, well, I do sit on my butt all day writing, but playing poker is much more anxiety-producing, and you sweat out a lot of pounds. One of the things that Helen told me was that on her last trip to the World Series, she lost 5 pounds just playing at the table. A friend of mine recommended a personal trainer, and I told her I had 6 weeks to become a living poker weapon. And she gave me some yoga poses and some breathing exercises that were pretty useful.
So what kind of poker did you play in the World Series of Poker?
It's Texas Hold'em. That's sort of the Cadillac of poker. With Texas Hold'em, you get 2 down cards that no one else can see except for you. They're random, like a 9 and a 2 of different suits or a pair. Then there's the flop, which is 3 communal cards that everyone has. Mm-hmm. So you have your 2 down cards plus these communal cards, and people are making a match out of those 5 cards. And people are dropping off. Usually in a full table of 10, now you're down to 2 or 3 people because the flop has, you know, told them that things aren't going or aren't progressing. Turn over another communal card at the turn, and then finally the river. And you know whether you have a great hand or a terrible hand, whether the gods of poker have smiled or frowned upon you. And that's where you do your final dance of betting.
What was your background as a writer and a reporter? Was that helpful in terms of helping you to judge your competitors and figure out when they were bluffing?
Sort of a completely different skill. I mean, the one sort of thing that helped me was my personal demeanor. I have a good poker face because I'm half dead inside and don't really betray a lot of emotions. And so in playing in home games, people project a lot of things onto me. You know, I'm thinking about my failures, you know, things I did wrong 10 years ago. But to the other players, they think I'm, you know, I have like a great hand or something and I'm running a bluff. So my low bandwidth emotional state is actually a good poker face.
Are you really thinking about that, your failures of the past 10 years while you're playing poker?
Well, you know, the mind goes a lot of places.
Yeah,
there's a lot of downtime.
Yeah, you mentioned that the hands get very expensive. Like, how expensive? How much can you win or lose in a particular hand?
The year I played, the entrance fee was $10,000. Mm-hmm. And, like, I got $30,000 in chips. And so you're starting from there. And then it gets to the point where the ante that people are playing with on the final days is $10,000.
So how did you do? How far did you get in the World Series?
Well, you have to read the book. I didn't become a millionaire. You know, the top player that year made $8 million.
Wow.
If I'd made a couple hundred thousand, I would probably have taken, you know, some time off and I'd still be sailing around the world. I mean, it was a really important experience for me as someone who just hangs around the house, you know, in my terrible apartment, writing stuff all day, to actually have to go and be among people and test myself in a way I never do anymore. Was quite lovely, and that's why the article became a book.
As you mentioned, you have a good poker face because you're half dead inside, which is actually the opening line of your book. And this brings me to one of my favorite parts of your book, this whole idea of the Republic of Anhedonia. Can you tell me about that?
Well, you know, it's the World Series of Poker, not the American Series of Poker. And so which nation did I actually represent? I'm American, grew up in New York, but what's my real sort of spiritual homeland? The Republic of Anhedonia really sort of described where I feel I come from. Anhedonia, it's a psychological term, meaning the inability to experience pleasure, feel pleasure. I can relate in different, you know, times in my life to being apart from sort of other people and other people's joy. And then I got a sweatshirt at a design-your-own sweatshirt place that says the Republic of Anhedonia on it with lightning bolts so I could, you know, have my country sort of on my chest as I played.
That's the other thing I wondered about. I'm curious about how serious you are about this idea of being Anhedonian, because if you're a citizen of the Republic of Anhedonia, I must be at least maybe a president, because you're Colson Whitehead, for crying out loud. You know, award-winning, critically acclaimed novelist, MacArthur genius. Do you really have that much trouble experiencing pleasure?
It's a comic persona, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's a way of talking about the world. But obviously, you know, if everyone was actually happy personally, the world would be a much better place. So I think the Republic of Anhedonia, the census count is much bigger than, you know, people are really aware of.
Would it be fair to say that you have an Anhedonian worldview? Do you think you look at the world with kind of through an Anhedonian lens, if you know what I mean?
I do have a despairing view of the world, but you have to hope things will get better, and, you know, for my daughter and her friends. And I think as humans, we are always balancing our trajectory towards tragedy or despair and our more hopeful moments. And for me, you know, in my work as I move from book to book, I wrestle with these different parts of my personality. Sag Harbor, which is a coming-of-age story about kids growing up in the 80s, is very optimistic. No matter what happens to the protagonist, he always thinks things will get better. And then the book after that was about the end of the world, a plague that, you know, kills 99% of the population, and it's very, you know, sort of depressing. And that expresses another part of my personality.
In The Noble Hustle, you mention the Republic of Anhedonia's national anthem. And I think it's important for me to learn this, being that I consider myself a fellow Anhedonian. And as you mentioned, there are a lot of Anhedonians out there, whether we know it or not. Would you mind singing a bit of it for me?
Sure. I mean, it's composed of grunts, sighs, and moans, depending on what's happening today. So,
in the book, you do it while the Star-Spangled Banner is being played. We have that queued up. Would that help to hear that? And would that help?
Sure.
Okay. Well, Joe, our engineer, will cue it, and then you can just go at it.
All righty.
No, not again. Please, one moment.
So that's my rendition.
That was great. That was wonderful. I think I got it. I've got this to listen to and practice. Thank you for doing that. That was wonderful, Colson. I see that this. I'm not the only one that this whole Anhedonia thing resonates with. There's this Facebook page for it, and some people have created travel posters for it, and even a map of Anhedonia, which includes the Puddle of Sorrows and the Dismal Forest. It sounds to me like Anhedonia would make a great setting for a dystopian novel. Or do you feel that Anhedonia is where all your fiction takes place already?
No, I think partially I'm drawing from, you know, my childhood in that land. I grew up, we had cable TV in my household. It meant we didn't have to talk to each other. And so I'd be like 9 or 10 and watching George Carlin and Richard Pryor. And the way that they could, you know, mix in jokes with terrible personal histories or very satirical takes on modern life, you know, I connected to very early. Like, how do you get people to recognize the horror of existence and then also make them laugh and appreciate, you know, small moments of beauty.
That's Colson Whitehead talking about his book, The Noble Hustle. He spoke with Doug Gordon. And that's it for our show today. If you have comments or questions, we'd love to hear from you. You can post your comments on our website at ttbook.org or visit our Facebook page. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio in Madison, Wisconsin. This hour was put together by Steve Paulson with help from Charles Monroe Kane, Sarah Nix, Raymond Tungekar, and the irrepressible Doug Gordon. Our theme music is by Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. I'm Ann Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.